water, earth, fire, air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar, and although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end. And like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexities of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. After concluding our coverage of Avatar: The Last Airbender, we decided to continue exploring the world of bending by covering the comics and now following the journey of Avatar Korra as she navigates the post-war world.
Last week, Korra managed to heal herself by connecting to her inner energy and those who love her. She reunited with Jenora, Iki, and Milo and headed to Zaofu to intervene in Kuvera's occupation of the city. Things went awry when Korra's trauma continued to haunt her, allowing Kuvera to defeat her. This week, we'll learn more about the weapon Kuvera is developing and go on a secret mission with Opal, Lin, and Bolin in episodes 7 through 10 of Book 4, Balance.
You're a good person. You just said defeat her like she didn't wash her. Like, really, like, it's very nice of you.
Listen, everyone has a bad day.
It's true. It's true. And when you're the Avatar, everybody sees it. And because we also don't want to be so afraid to disappoint anyone that we end up disappointing everyone, you've come to the right place for adult content, okay? We're going to have some adult content. So if you're down like Prince Wu, let's get into it.
Episode 7, Reunion. After her stunning defeat by Kuvera, Korra returned to Air Temple Island, where she reunited with Naga, Bumi, Tenzin, and Pema.
She just looked sad coming off the back of the bison. You just knew right away she had bad news. It's like one of those things, you see somebody walking up and you read their body language and you're like, damn it, what's happened?
Well, yes, she just got her ass handed to her. A child had to save her again.
Again. All right. Once again. Oh, Jenora, what would you be without her?
I know. Like, would the show would have probably ended in book 2 without Jenora. Anyway.
Is Jenora really the Avatar? Like, did somebody mess up? Is Aang's granddaughter the Avatar? I need somebody to do, like, the test. Like, let's do the Avatar test on both of them again right now.
So Tenzin waste no time. He's like, oh, it's so good to see you. Anyway, what happened in Zaofu? Even Bumi and Boomjoon are like, okay, I guess we're just getting right into business.
Yeah, exactly.
So Korra gives him an update, and they all kind of wonder, what happened with Bolin? Is Bolin still on the wrong side of this? Bolin is in the Earth Kingdom, the Earth Empire, and he's literally carrying Varric on his back. Carrying him.
Like
not
a backpack.
Carrying him emotionally. Like carrying him actually.
Yes. And Varric is a mess. And he's like, you know, like, he has to, I mean, he drops his ass. He's like, listen, I'm not Zhu Li. All right, I'm not freaking Julie. You need to get it together, bro.
It's Varric is a broken man.
Very much so.
I would say it's sad to see it, but I'm not sad.
No, especially when you start with, especially when this next part happens, when Bolin calls him out that you're about to talk about. Like, yes, no, there's nothing. You think about all the shit that he's done. You're like, ugh, yeah, he needs to atone.
Yeah, Bolin basically gives him a pep talk and is like, you can't just be like a lump here. We have to get moving. So they press on, and Varric says Bolin can, he'll carry him on his back.
Yeah.
And Varric takes like 3 steps, and then they're captured by a bunch of escape prisoners from Kuvira.
And Bolin's through. He's like, are you serious right now? Like, I've been carrying you all, so you take 1 or 2 steps and now we're in a trap. But I just don't want to move past, because Bolin calls him out on like, hey, you got to do this because of the fact that you have created all this stuff and you can't just get out that easy. I love that Bolin held it like, yo, you're not going to get off that easy. Like, just be like, oh, leave me here. I'm holding you down. And he's like, no, bro, like, you're the reason why we got to rush back.
Fair. And Bolin's right. I mean,
he's right.
100%. Varric needs a redemption arc for sure.
I mean, last time, listen, it's wild that we're even still talking about this guy, because he's like done so much shit, blown up buildings, like freaking started a civil war, jumped out of a prison during an explosion. This guy is a fucking criminal. Like, it doesn't make any sense, running a criminal enterprise. But he's I guess we love him. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of prisoners who capture them, and you know, they're screwed basically, because now they're caught by the other side.
Because they lead off with like, we were in Kavera's in a circle. You might want to check which side these people are on before you start throwing that one out there.
Yeah. So back in Republic City, Cora is having lunch with Asami, Mako, and unfortunately Prince Wu. Mako realizes pretty early in the conversation that Cora has been writing to Asami, but not him and Bolin. And Cora apologizes as they catch up. She's very skeptical about Asami's relationship with her father, because Asami basically says, I've decided to forgive him.
Yeah, I don't like this by Cora, and I'm actually on Asami's side. Like, you don't get to come in after 3 years of just writing letters and say, hey, I get that you know my dad, but it's still my dad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, as long as, like, where's the trust that you have in me? I'm literally the one who brought him down. Like, you think I'm just going to be like, oh, yeah, cool, let him go back and do his shit?
Yeah, I have torn feelings about this whole exchange, because I think that Mako is justifiably angry about the fact that Cora did communicate with Asami. Like, I think if Cora didn't communicate with anybody, then he wouldn't feel hurt by this. But the fact that she just didn't write back to him in Bolin is upsetting. And then I don't think Cora does a good enough job sort of explaining to them what she's been through. But then again, she's been through a lot. Is she really obligated to explain to them what she's been through? I don't know. It felt very much like everybody at this table was judging each other in unfair ways. And sometimes it's like that when you haven't seen people in a while, and then suddenly you're trying to go back to like how things were before, and you can't always go back. So this reunion was a little tense. And because it got tense, Prince Wu, needing a distraction, just demands that Mako take him to the bathroom. But this time, Mako's in his feelings, and he's like, nah, go to the bathroom yourself.
Oh, because he thought, you know, he's got all that. He's like, I'm the man, and he's got embarrassed now that Cora was like, I'm not even checking for you, bro. He's like feeling, he's in his feels, like you said. Oh, God, freaking Mako and Prince Wu, the combo at that table. I wish Asami and Cora just like hung out on their own on this one. But that's just me.
So I am a person who generally does not care for Drake jokes.
Yeah.
But there's a Drake joke about Mako being in his feelings right now. There really is. There's a joke in there about Mako being too much in his feelings. Bring it down a notch, Mako. He's trying to essentially show that he's not Prince Wu's like assistant. And he is. You
he
are.
Is the assistant. He wants to. He's out, so you're saying basically he just jumped out the car and he's doing a dance with scrolling like Cora. Are you with me? Are you riding? Like that's what's going on. Cora, are you with me? Are you riding? Are you in it? Yeah, I got you. I get what you're putting down. I see it. I see what's going on.
Just, I'm just saying, I was getting heavy Drake vibes from Mako in this whole run of episodes.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure. And then, I mean, it's kind of irresponsible. There's been multiple kidnapping and assassination attempts. What? Just because your homie comes back in town is like, is that like, yeah, sure. I mean, just go on your own. You're fine. And of course, like, do you always go to the bathroom with him? I mean, not all the time, but sometimes. No, all the time, bro. You go all the time.
Yeah, you're his bodyguard. You're supposed
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
So, of course, Prince Wu gets kidnapped. And Team Avatar has to go chase after him. Mm-hmm. So he gets kidnapped and they end up following the truck that he was kidnapped in. It was, I believe, a laundry truck in Asami's car. And even in this interaction, Mako's out here like barking instructions at Asami and Cora, completely forgetting that they're both badasses in their own right. And
big flex by Asami. Big flex. Huge flex. Like, I know more about these roads. I literally built some of them.
Yeah. Woo! Yeah. She's like, take several seats, sir. Yeah. So, you know, they lose him because the laundry truck that they're following, it turns out he's not in there. They transferred him somewhere else. They manage to capture one of the kidnappers who tells them that Prince Wu is probably halfway to Kavira by now. Mm. Not knowing where to start to look for Wu, Cora decides to touch one of the spirit vines, and she's able to see that Wu is on his way to the train station.
Leveling up those avatar skills. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Toph Beifong. Thank you.
So back in the forest, the escaped prisoners tell Bolin and Varric that they were in one of Kavira's prison camps because she's been locking up anyone who isn't of Earth Kingdom origin. Wow. These prisoners are from the Fire Nation and Water Tribes. I think this is new information.
It is.
Pretty stunning that she's doing this. It just sort of shows how deranged she is. Mm-hmm. I mean, since the war ended, people have been moving freely between the nations. So this
she's basically approximating what Ozai did, but on the Earth Kingdom or Earth Empire's behalf, right? It's like she's like, it feels very much like when the Fire Nation attacked. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it just this is uncomfortable for me in so many ways. I was actually kind of stunned by this. Mm-hmm. I don't think I picked this up on my first watch. You know, dissenters, we knew people who didn't comply with her, sure, but people who just happened to be from the other nations, that is a new level of cruelty. You know, she's just essentially picking on them because they're not of Earth Kingdom origin. And what does that even mean anymore? I'm sitting here like, but what about the people who like, what about people like Mako and Bolin?
It means absolutely nothing in this new world, which is part of why she's doing what she's doing misguidedly. It means absolutely nothing because Aang and Zuko, along with the rest of Team Avatar, really saw to it that it would mean a lot less after the Hundred Year War.
Yeah, you know I mean? Mako is a firebender.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother is an earthbender. It just doesn't, where would their allegiance fall? It's really mind-boggling. So the prisoners basically say that they need them to get past the checkpoint, especially since they were in Kavira's inner circle. Mm-hmm. And Bolin decides that he's going to fight back using his lava bending to create distance between them. And he says, we can't really help you get through the checkpoint because we're fugitives. Everybody's mm-hmm. looking for us. Mm-hmm. A prisoner named Baraz tells them that there's a wall around the entire kingdom. I also think this is new information.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only way to get out is to go through the checkpoint. He says that they're going to have to trust each other to get through this.
Yeah, because a lot of his people were like, we can't trust these guys. They'll turn us in, and they look like, you know, they're working for the other side. How do we know they won't? And he's like, listen, if they're who they say they are, this is really our only shot, you know what I mean, for each other.
Right. Right. And he makes the point that if they wanted to kill them or they wanted to harm them, Bolin could have done that with the lava. Like, there's nothing stopping them from destroying them.
Yep.
So Bolin and Varric lead the group through the checkpoint. And they use some fast talking to get through. It's actually quite funny. Like, Varric just goes from like 0 to 100 immediately with the, do you want me to report you to Kavira? You know how that will go.
We all know what happens to you when she doesn't get what she wants. You can either, you know, argue right now or have me lead us through this tunnel. And they're like, he's like, man. And it's funny because Bolin was jacking it. Bolin was like, I'm going to take it from here. Like, he's going to be the one to talk. And thank God Varric jumped in. Because he was like, can I get your paperwork? I stuffed it down a badger mole's mouth.
Also, Varric is so overdramatic. He's so, as much as I don't like Varric as a person, he's funny. The guy's funny.
Hugely funny. Yeah. Hilarious.
So they almost make it through. And then one of the guards stops them because he recognizes them. Baraz says, I ain't going back to prison no matter what. No, without discussing it with anyone, he's basically like, I'm not going back. There, a whole fight breaks out. Varric sneaks into one of the offices and sets up a magnetic device that basically cripples all the mecha tanks. And they escape with the others and eventually accept an offer to sail north with them. They're heading north and Varric and Bolin need a ride. In Republic City.
Begrudgingly.
Well, Varric is like, I'm used to being in luxury.
That thing? I'm allergic to drowning, kid.
this little rickety boat is not going to do it for me. It gets the job done, though.
It does.
So, back in Republic City, Korra, Asami, and Mako make it to the train station. They split up to look for Wu. Korra is able to sense where Wu is on one particular train, and so they jump on that train and find him. But they're attacked by some of Kavira's people as soon as they find him. There's a whole big escape scene on the roof of the train. It is really dope. I can't even describe it.
Once again,
Asami just proving she doesn't need no bending.
No. No.
My girl is a skilled fighter. Really, really good.
Yeah, she wrecks him. I do have issues with the fact that Korra can not only find and sense things by touching the spirit vines, but she can also do it by touching the train platform. I wanted to talk about this.
I don't understand this.
Yeah.
How does she have this ability? Like, I don't. Maybe somebody smarter than me can figure this out.
Here's what I put in my head canon, but it's not explained. Because I fought with this a little bit when I watched this episode. And I said, okay, the vines allow her to see everything really clearly throughout everywhere with the spirit, through like just going through the vines. But if she was with Toph long enough, and Toph has all the seismic sense, she maybe doesn't have seismic sense, but maybe she's taught her a little bit about how to feel and feel things and see things without eyes because she was with Toph. That was the only place I could get to that made it make some sort of sense to me, but it still didn't feel like it was explained.
Yeah, I think I'm going to just go ahead and give them the benefit of the doubt that I'm missing something here, but this power doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand why Korra can do this. I just don't get it. But it is what it is. It is a plot point. So
yeah,
I'm just going to assume that it's explained, not necessarily explained, but it's implied somewhere and I missed it. But I don't get why Korra is able to do this. But anyway, they get to safety and, you know, Wu is very grateful. He hits on Korra, which is, she just shuts it down.
She's like, really? You're going to ask me out right now? Like, after we just jumped off a train? Is that what you're going to do? Okay. No, how about never? How about that's never going to happen? Okay?
So good. So now he has been rejected by both of Mako's exes.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So she also apologizes for her rough homecoming and how tense and awkward things are. And they all make up because that's how it is. So Mako decides that he's going to take Wu to the place where his his grandmother and the rest of his family has been hiding since the fall of Ba Sing Se. And it's Asami's house.
Wow. Asami just keeps coming through in the clutch. How good a person is she, man? Golly.
And also, Asami and Mako until recently haven't seen each other in a long time. So the fact that she's still housing their family, very kind of her, you know?
100%.
She obviously just does it out of the goodness of her heart. Grandmother Yin is starstruck by Prince Wu.
The monarchist through and through.
The fans that he's been looking for all this time and never got. All he needed to do was head over to Asami's house.
Yeah, he knew the exact right place. He knew exactly where to take him. Like, it was right. Mako's call on this was exactly right, because grandma's going to give him all the fan treatment that he needs, you know, right there.
Yeah, she's just, like, extremely honored to be in the presence of royalty. It's very amusing.
And she then he runs and uses the bathroom in a strange place where you just got kidnapped. You're not worried about using the bathroom? Like, I know Mako's saying this is his family. You're just like, hey, I got to go use the bathroom. Ugh, what a weirdo.
Wu grows on me over the course of the season.
He does too. Yes, of course he does. That's the point. But it's just funny that like after you just got kidnapped for using the bathroom, your first instinct was like, I gotta go use the bathroom.
Well, I guess he never got to go.
I guess, yeah, I'm just about to say, he never did get to go.
He still has to go. Nature calls. So meanwhile, Batard Jr. has discovered the swamp, and he tests the vines there, finding that they're even more powerful than the samples that they took from Republic City. This excites Kavira, who tells him to harvest the vines until there's nothing left. And that's the end of that episode.
God, I loathe Jr. Oh my God, he's like a less enthusiastic Zhao to me. golly. So the next episode is Remembrances, which is a screenplay that should have been written and acted out by the Ember Island players. I don't know what happened here, but I'm just going to say we need Avatar Day. We need Avatar by the Ember Island players. Maybe they're not a traveling company. I'm not sure, but man, it would have helped. So in Asami's house, Wu and Mako are sparring because they got to toughen them up a little bit.
Wu down!
He said, you're so freaking soft that's your catchphrase. Wu down. Oh, man. Grandma immediately comes in and coddles Prince Wu. She's like, oh, do you want some of that, something to drink? And he says, and maybe a little bit of those, he has a snack that he likes. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely terrible. But Mako's like, listen, you got to toughen up and you got to figure this out, because you're going to be in charge of people. But he understands how he's feeling, and he talks to him and tells his story. So in the midst of it, he tells Wu that he used to date the Avatar. And to which Wu was like, oh, no, sit down. I need all the details. You're going to spill the tea here today, sir. And so he does. He starts telling the story about how he met Korra. And he tells how rude he was when he first met Korra. He tells the mission that Korra and he went on when Bolin was taken by the Equalist. He goes through the whole messy love triangle.
I did not appreciate reliving the love triangle. Or really should we call it a love square? Because Bolin was in the mix for a while, too.
Yeah, we'll call it a square.
I deeply resent that I've spent more hours of my life on this love triangle.
They had to bring it back for some reason. And Grandma was not pleased about it either. To which she's like, naughty Mako, you take after your grandfather.
I need more information. What
I'm with you.
I need more information. What's going on with Grandpa?
So are some of these kids illegitimate? Because there was a lot of cousins. There was a big family there. What's going on? So Wu, Grandma Yin, and Mako's cousin too drag Mako relentlessly about how he deals with women. It is a sight to behold. It's one of the best, right? So the thing I like about this episode is, like, the part that makes it funny is they borrow, when they have the characters talking, similar kind of caricatures for the pop-ups as, like, the Great Divide episode, like at the end, like where we find out about where Aang's telling the story. When you look at the way they drew the people's faces, you're like, oh, that's really interesting. And it was a nice callback for me because they're doing this thing that kind of like is similar to what Ember Island episode did when they were retelling the whole story of the Team Avatar. But it ties it in just really nicely for me. Anyway, it looks like you know, pop-ups on your text message thread. It's really cool. So as they're talking to him about how he communicates and how his actual feelings and how he did this lying to Korra about her lost memories when she comes back after they broke up. Basically, Two is like, you're so afraid to disappoint anyone that you end up disappointing everyone. And you know what? This was a very good articulation of what we couldn't really put a finger on. We don't love about Mako. I think it's exactly what is wrong and going on with Mako, in my opinion. And Mako ends up telling him that in the end, Korra taught him the importance of helping other people, and he's still inspired by her.
I mean, great. I'm glad he got that lesson. This is a whole mess, though. It just reminded me of how disastrous Mako was for the first two seasons of this show.
Oh, he was bad. He was like, really, really bad.
This guy is so unlikable. It's just like, I don't know. It's rough. Like, he hurt Asami so many times for no reason at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the thing that's interesting is once the whole love relationship thing, or he's going to hook up with this person, or he likes Asami, he likes a girl, was taken out of the mix, I actually do agree with Mako's take about himself. He actually becomes a better person once he gets past the awkwardness in season 3 and 4. Like, there's like things that like I like about what Mako does in these two seasons that would never happen if we still had to deal with him trying to figure out who he loved more and blah, blah. It's like, better Mako just focus on being a detective and solving crimes.
Yeah, because Mako really does come through in book 3, right? Yep. But I just think it's funny that he caused so much harm to... I think Asami got really the short end of the stick here. Because when Korra and him broke up, Korra was the one who, like, finally broke up. Korra was like, this don't work. This is not... Like, she got to the point where she understood that their relationship just didn't work. I think Asami has always gone to Mako when she needs someone. And he... Mm-hmm. really betrayed her that last time. But by the time that like he's coming to realize the consequences of what he did, Asami and Korra are both over it in book 3. Yeah. They're like, yeah, okay. Like, 100%. Yeah, we've moved on. So I do think I've seen some character growth from Mako, but this trip down memory lane, I'm not sure why it was necessary, because it just reminded me why I didn't like him to begin with.
Yeah, I'm telling you, this is like the creators, like, we gotta, you know, that Ember Island, Ember Players thing? We need that. But it didn't really do the same thing, but it still was cool to see some flashbacks. I kind of felt like it would have been better if we saw it in play form, because I just wanted to see somebody like brood and act out Mako being ridiculous.
This episode feels like a filler in some points, but then the end is actually quite good.
Really so, important. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So back on Air Temple Island, Asami brings Korra some tea, and Korra confides that Toph's words about the world not needing her are still really bothering her. And Asami is like, right away, like, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's a ride or die. She's like, Toph is wrong. Like, she's wrong. Like, and she tries to comfort her, and she begins to tell her about how hard it's been to continually fight and still find the world is out of balance, is what Korra says. And, you know, Korra talks about how optimistic she was until she saw Aman take someone's bending away, and how scared she was when she lost her own bending. And Asami reminds her that after taking down Aman, free elections were held, and hopefully they'll vote Raiko out. No, she doesn't say that. I just added that part.
That was my thought, too. I was like, free elections happened, but they weren't great. So can we have another election?
Yeah, the people, I feel like didn't choose the right guy. But anyway, they were held, and she talks about how non-benders finally had a voice in the city. And for her, that's really powerful, right? Because she's not a bender. So like, this is good for her to be saying this. Like, hey, you really help with that. And however, as soon as Korra defeated Aman, Unalaq took his place. Because of Unalaq, she opened the portal and opened the world up to chaos and losing the connection to her past lives. Asami reminds her that she was able to defeat Unavatu and opening the portals and resulted in bringing back all the airbenders and the air nomads.
This is Jenora Erasure.
This is Jenora Erasure. Like, what the fuck?
What is going on?
What the fuck? Like, Jenora became a freaking orb and globe and glowed. Like, she just came out of nowhere and, like, you know, did it. It was like, you know, Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz's fairy godmother just came down. She just came down and she's like, hey, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless you and make sure I take this away. I don't know why they did Jenora like this, but, you know, Asami's trying to big her girl up.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, yeah. She needs to pump her up.
I mean, it's not the best time to be like, you would have died except for a child saved you. It's not that probably wouldn't have gone over super well.
It would have been funny. That's wild, like, to come up with that take. Like, you're probably right. You probably would have been lost if you didn't have Jenora.
The world would still be in chaos if a, like, 12-year-old girl had not saved your butt.
Exactly. So, So basically she says, yeah, but this too also had negative consequences because Zaheer became an airbender, even though she, you know, brought back the air nomads and killed the Earth Queen, leading to the collapse of the Earth Kingdom and the rise of Kavera. So she's like, I just, all this stuff just dominoes. Like, I keep, like, having the same problem. And Tenzin arrives to tell Korra and Asami that it's true, that there will always be new enemies, but that it's important to learn from your enemies. This is echoing what Toph was telling her. Like, when she was in the swamp and Toph turns to her and kind of just says, you know, you need to, like all of your enemies had some kind of noble purpose that they wanted, but they just were out of balance. They were lost, right? They just took it way too far. And so he says, you know, you can learn from your enemies to become better over time. Tenzin notes how when Korra arrived, she was hot-headed and selfish. And now she's become an inspiration to the world who has put others first. And he draws the idea that, look at what you did for the air nomads. Like, this is like huge, like what you did. And she said, you know what? Thank you, guys. You know, I'm not always going to get it right, but I'm never going to stop trying to bring the world into balance. And this is a beautiful shot from Air Temple Island, which was like, wow, this is really well drawn and looks amazing.
Yeah, I have to say, this part of the episode I did think was necessary. And yeah. I think that this is, it almost felt like, and you know, listeners, remember, Paul and I are coming to these stories after they had aired, right? Mm-hmm. So the fandom was already in place when we came to this story. Mm. This feels like a direct response to the fans who are irritated by Korra, mm-hmm. by the fact that she has a new villain every year, by the fact that she makes so many mistakes. This felt like a direct, okay, yes, Korra makes mistakes. That is the point. Mm-hmm. The point is that she is not perfect and she makes errors, but she's also done a lot of good. She's changed the way that the world functions. This felt like a good response to me. Tenzin and Asami do a really good job of outlining all the good that she's done despite the unintended consequences.
Yeah, I agree. There's it's really a nod to that. And I also think what I really love about this is that it kind of ties in all the different struggles she had. And it really does, for me anyway, this is the moment where I start seeing them begin to bring the whole thing home, that Korra is transforming and she went through all of this pain, and we'll get to this later, for a reason, and that she had to deal with all this because she was a little too selfish and hot-headed, and she had lessons that she had to learn different than Aang to be able to become a real, like, the avatar that she's meant to be. And it took all these bumps and bruises that we've seen her through, but it also shows that each one of these people, if you think about it, were really connected to her struggles as the avatar, a spiritual connection. It was like they each had a spiritual connection to what she was dealing with and needed to find out at the time. So really, really, really cool. So on the ship that Bolin and Varric
are
on.
Are we calling this a ship? It's really a boat. It's really a boat.
It's a little rickety. No question.
So I've been playing The Witcher some more.
Yeah.
And like there's ships in that story when you play The Witcher 3. And then there's plenty of times where Geralt gets on like a rickety boat and has to go like across the world. And this is what it reminded me. I was like, this is a little bit better than Geralt's rickety boat that he uses to get across the ocean, like, on the regular.
That's funny. That is hilarious. Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely not. It's definitely, that is definitely on that status. for sure. But basically, as they're with the escapees, Varric is bored by all their stories. He's like, I tuned out a long time ago.
So rude.
In the meantime, started crafting a story that's the greatest story that you'll ever hear. The story of Bolin, played by Nucktuck, who is played by Bolin.
This did have me in stitches. It is actually just, it's incredibly, it's just a mess. It's a mess, but it's a funny mess. It's a funny mess. Go on. I'm sorry.
It is a mess. It is a mess that leaves Unalaq on red. Oh my god, it's so great. Don't put that fucking guy in the group chat, all right? Like, he's not welcome. Fuck him. Block him, okay? Like, you betrayed your brother, your niece, your kids. Fuck that guy. Even Vatu is like, fuck that guy. Vatu's like, I'm out on him.
I just love that nobody likes Unalaq.
Yeah.
Everybody
had one job.
Yeah. But they all just like, is he on the call?
Is he gonna be here? Is you know who coming? Oh my gosh. It's sort of like, I'm telling you, speaking of Drake earlier, it's sort of like when Kanye added Pusha T to their group text and he was like, fuck that. I'm out. Oh my gosh, so fucking terrible. Like, it's so great. So the story that Varric has been crafting as he's tuned out everybody else's story, which basically is his MO. He's never asked anybody about their life because he doesn't know shit about anybody. He's just like, yeah, you don't know anything about me. So the story begins with a wise merchant in the south.
Wonder who that is.
I wonder. Who's also like a mogul. Who's also like a guy who can levitate. How do you fit all those people on one pillow? It's the same guy. It's fucking Varric. And he's, you know, talking about the time he met Bolin for the first time. It's also somehow become a musical. And he comes in and starts singing. Bolin sings to him, show me my master, show me my guide. I need some. And he's like, first of all, Asami's my friend. I didn't come in with a dame on my arm. All right. Second of all, there was no singing. And third of all, you don't fucking levitate. Okay, my guy? Like, calm down. Bolin's great. So he corrects him and he starts talking about the meeting where his story should start with is with Korra, which I thought was really cool. And he tells about when they met at the Bending Arena. It gets really kind of like cool, but also Bolin is not as good a storyteller as Varric. So Varric's
there's no
like,
music. There's no music in it, which is a big problem.
Yeah, and you know, it kind of surprised me that Bolin struggled this way because he definitely learned the showmanship from Varric with that time when they were there and they were trying to find airbenders and how he like told them, you gotta, you know, put on a show. So the fact that he struggled to keep the story going was kind of wild, but
I think he's trying to tell the actual story though, and Varric is just making stuff up.
Varric's just making a mover. He's just like, I'm gonna make a fucking mover. I don't care. I'm taking artistic license with your life. And so Varric continues the story and he takes, you know, all kinds of creative licenses. In this version, Zaheer and Vatu worked together. Well, I guess kind of. They kind of did. Zaheer knew about Vatu, but he didn't
want...
Yeah,
but they weren't, like, working directly together.
No, that's just...
It's just... There's a conference call between Zaheer...
Is Zaheer here? Hey, Vatu.
The best part is that Vatu is in the tree prison when Zaheer calls.
Hey, how's it going? You know, sitting here in the tree, not able to go anywhere. Like, I can get out of here. Oh my gosh, it's so good. The dialogue here is phenomenal. Like, they really did make it more fun than it was to go through that and not make it heavy. And so, you know, as they're talking, they conference in, as we talked about, Amon, Unalaq, and nobody likes Unalaq.
Don't forget, Amon is a zombie.
Amon is a zombie. How is he a zombie? It's crazy. Well, he died. That's right. So he's a zombie. Oh my God. Oh my gosh. So freaking crazy.
It's just a complete disaster, but it's still funny. I still find it very amusing.
He changes whole parts of the story. He starts saying that it's Bolin that turns into the large, like, being that fights Vatu instead of Korra. He, like, has all these different things. All of them apparently are plotting against Bolin because he's, like, the star of the thing, the ladies' man. Bolin starts crying when Varric mentions Opal. He starts bawling, and he's really sad. And Varric's like, get yourself together, kid. Got a story to tell. But it shows you that Bolin is still really, really distraught about how things have gone with Opal and that she may not forgive him. So Bolin comes to Varric for advice and Opal forgiving him.
Yeah, she turns him into an airbender, apparently, when they kiss.
Yeah, I forgot about that somebody turns into an airbender. Oh my gosh. This guy is not at all connected with the truth, but he doesn't care. He's just going with the story. And in the finale, he turns the hair into wind and turns into a huge spirit, defeating Unuvatu with the help of a fairy.
Janora erasure.
Say her name, okay? Janora, say her name, all right? This is what it is. And this whole story is a mess. And again, Varric gives zero fucks. He's like, listen, I'm trying to tell a story. I don't care about the truth. And that's where it ends.
It's so good. I really thoroughly enjoy that part of the episode.
Part is the worst part of the show. The worst part of this episode without the Grant was Mako and the love triangle. But the reality of it is that thank God for Grandma, Prince Wu, and his cousin. Because they literally tell the story, make the story better. But yeah, that the other two scenes I think are really vital and fun.
Yeah, they're good. So episode 9 is called Beyond the Wilds. The episode begins with Ryu, you know, the guy who was living in his parents' basement before they went to get him to become an airbender.
And Mama's proud.
His parents are so happy that he's out of their house. They're both there. He's giving a tour to a bunch of tourists of the Spirit Wilds in Republic City. One of the vines begins to approach them, and one of the tourists is like, I'm going to go poke it with a stick. This was very triggering as a New Yorker. Like, just tourists just acting like they could do whatever. It's just rough. And so the vines start to attack everyone. And they basically capture everyone. And we don't see what happens. On Air Temple Island, Opal's having a tough time because Kavira has her family and no one seems to care. And in fairness to Opal, I agree, there's no urgency to get back Sue and the rest of her family.
Yeah.
Korra comforts her and basically says, we do care. We're just trying to figure out what to do next. And then Janora arrives and says she felt something. Something changed in the Spirit Wilds.
Maybe she ate something bad. Maybe it was just bad food that she ate. This was Opal's take when they got to the Spirit Wild. Maybe say something bad.
So they all head to the Spirit Wilds, and Korra connects to the vines and sees what's happening in the swamp, which is that Batar Jr. is out here harvesting the vines. Janora says that she will stay behind to look for Ryu and the others, and Opal suggests going straight to Ryko so that the other leaders can figure out how to take Kavira down.
Has nobody figured that it's better to, like, circumvent going directly to Ryko, that he doesn't do shit unless it's for his own benefit? Like, why not go straight to Tenzin?
I agree, but I can understand why they don't. Because remember, they tried to circumvent him before with Iroh, and that didn't work out.
Oh, that's right. Then he, like, threw a whole shit fit and kicked her out of the town.
Yeah, so I kind of get it. They're trying, Korra is trying to live within the the rules.
I got it. Yeah.
So when they arrive at, so it's City Hall. Tenzin, Fire Lord Izumi, Raiko, Lin, and Prince Wu are discussing what to do about Kavira.
Can we just say shout out to fucking like Fire Lord Izumi and shout out to former Fire Lord Zuko? I mean, great to see her. Like, great to see who's actually all these references to her. We finally get eyes on her.
Yeah, we've seen her before, but she's never spoken.
Exactly.
So this is what cool. I mean. I appreciated this. We actually got a, like, her perspective, which exactly. was cool. So Raiko is suddenly ready to fight. He's like, we gotta go after Kavira, but Tenzin is like, we can't attack her first. Lin, because she's always down for a fight, yeah. agrees with Raiko. And Korra arrives just as they're having this argument and is insulted because Prince
I would
Wu,
be too.
I would be insulted. I was insulted for Korra. Prince Wu is invited to this little conference of the world leaders, but Korra is not.
Yeah. You invited him, but not me?
Yeah. It's so just as she's starting to talk to them about what's going on in the Spirit Wilds, Varric and Bolin bust in, and Raiko is like, arrest them on sight.
I mean, for good reason. They're both fucking fugitives from it's justice, great. And they're on the wrong side of this thing. And one was like literally, he got out of prison, got saved by Sue, and then betrayed Sue to roll with Kavira and go against the very same people who pardoned him a second time. That motherfucker gets no more chances. You're done with chances, bro.
I agree. I think this was Raiko's best move by far.
Best move ever. Like, I normally am out on this guy. I thought this was a very good take.
So Bolin announces that they have top secret information for them. So the guards let them go. And Korra adds that Kavira is harvesting the vines in the swamp. Mm. At this point, both Fire Lord Izumi and Tenzin say that their people cannot be part of any kind of unprovoked attack. And they have very different reasons. Tenzin isn't, you know, of the Air Nation. They don't attack people preemptively. We've always known this. They're try to stay nonviolent as much as they can. Izumi says that she's not going to drag the Fire Nation into another endless war unless she has no choice. And I respect that. I do.
And I want to talk about that at some point. I mean, honestly, I'd take 2 seconds to just say I really respected it too. But I also think that the history of the tribal wars in the Fire Nation leading up to all the way to the 100-year war and what that is, I just think that in that moment, she showed so much understanding of what her father had tried to had fixed about the Fire Nation of like, we're down to help out. We're down to lend our resources. We are not down to be aggressors in a war. Like, we will be here to defend. We will be here to protect. We are not down to draw first blood because of our history and what we've done already, which I thought was really profound.
It's an important... I don't agree with the decision, but I respect it because it's an important part of changing the culture of the Fire Nation to say we do not attack unprovoked. So while I think that they're making a mistake, because I agree with Opal, she got to go. Let's go back to Iroh's words about Azula. She is crazy and she has to go down. This is... Kavira is a menace and she has to be taken down. But I totally respect both Tenzin and Izumi's positions here, which is that their history does not, and their culture, the cultural shift that they're trying to create in the Fire Nation is not to attack first.
And it's an interesting dilemma because, you know, you see it in like West Wing when Zoe gets kidnapped and President Bartlett is like making decisions from an emotional place. You also have to reflect on the fact that her son is the top general in the Fire Nation fleet, right? That's what we've assessed.
Well, in the United Republic fleet.
So to send people into harm's way also sends her family into harm's way, which sometimes is interesting to think about that. Like, she's making a decision about her family, other people's families. And I think, like, on some level, she sees Kavira very much like her lineage. I mean, like, if you really think about it, Kavera, like we said earlier, is doing a lot of what Ozai did to unify the whole four nations, and she's almost ripped out the playbook and said, "Let me do it."
Yeah. So I totally agree with you. I liked this because we have, as you said, we haven't seen much of her, but it's mm-hmm. nice to see when we do see her, it's nice to hear her perspective and that she remembers history.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they basically, Raiko agrees to take defensive measures only, and Izumi agrees to provide support for that. And so does Tenzin. They say, okay, if you're going to defend Republic City from an attack, we will support that. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, Bolin tries to approach Opal and apologize, and she shuts him down. And she's basically like, nah, you betrayed my whole family. Look where we are today. I can't even deal with you. And he promises that he'll make it up to her.
She hits him with the Justin Bieber, "It's far too late to say I'm sorry." She hits him with it. She puts him over in the corner too. Like, you got to get out of here, bro. I'm not sorry.
Well, no, Lynn, it's too late. Lynn rolls up.
Yeah.
Immediately and says, "Listen, let's go get our family. Yeah. We can't depend on these idiots. Let's go do what we got to do."
Which I also respect. Which I also totally respect.
For a police chief, Lynn is often willing to work outside the law.
Listen. And now she's not even taking off the uniform. She's just like, I'm rolling.
Bolin also apologizes to Mako for saying all those mean things that he said to him. And they make up. In the Spirit Wilds, Jenora is still looking around, and she finds a place where the Vine captured the tour group. She attempts to escape, but she's also captured. But before she's fully taken under, she's able to project her spirit to Korra at City Hall. And she lets her know what's going on. Lynn very smartly immediately evacuates the area. And Korra and Mako head into the wilds to find Jenora. They're immediately attacked upon entry. But they find their way to a place where the tree has put the bodies of those who are captured into like little pods. While... Mm-hmm. trapping their spirits in the spirit world.
I do want to say that I like that there's one little nuance about Jenora's abilities is that, you know, and for once, Korra, here's your shot. You get to help Jenora because, like, she needs help right now. I mean, you did go into the spirit world and try to help her, even though she saved you ultimately. Okay. Point being that I'm trying to get at is I do like that it's not just viewable by the Avatar or other spiritually, like Mako saw Jenora, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. like I like that about her ability to project herself into these different places, that this is a real ability that she can do anywhere and people will see.
You know? Yeah, totally. So. I agree. I mean, we know that because she also spoke to Kai when he was in prison and he was able to see her. I think I actually think that this is a magical power they've explained.
Yep,
you know, this is not one that we're a little bit confused about. We know, we understand Jenora's abilities and the limitations of them.
I agree.
So Korra tries to spirit bend the tree, but she's not able to do it. And she decides to meditate into the spirit world to see if she can free the people that way. When she begins to meditate, she finds herself reliving her battle with Zaheer and being hurt again. And she pulls herself out of the meditation and tells Mako that she feels like Zaheer has been blocking her. She can't quite escape him. Mm. When they get outside the spirit wilds, Korra says to Tenzin that she wants to speak to Zaheer. And Tenzin doesn't want to do it. He's like, you're still not 100%. This guy is very dangerous. But he eventually relents and allows her to go.
She pulls a "you don't trust me either" card. Why you don't trust me either, Tenzin? Come on.
I mean, everyone thinks that Korra is not up to it, and I don't blame them. She's been really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So on Air Temple Island, Bolin asks Pabu to deliver a note to Opal. It says that he broke both of his legs.
Oh God!
But when she arrives, Bolin has actually planned a romantic picnic. And Opal is not about it.
She's a savage. She goes, I love it. She's like, oh, yeah, nice little picnic will just make me, like, totally forget that you had my family, like, taken and almost tried to overthrow the whole world. And blah. Yeah, sure, let's have a picnic. I'm sorry you have to see this, Pabu.
I think it's incredibly cute that both Opal and Bolin can understand Pabu when he speaks.
Yeah. I felt like I started to understand Pabu when he was talking about it. I was like, oh, wait, I get it.
I will admit, I feel like I kind of understand Bunjun and Pabu when they're talking.
Yeah, me too.
At City Hall, Raiko asked Varric and Asami to do something that they haven't done in a long time, which is work together and figure out how to stop Kuvira's super weapon. Asami lets Varric know that he's not going to fool her again, but she agrees to help. Korra goes outside the city and visits Zaheer in prison. And when she gets there, he tells her he knew she was going to come eventually.
I figured you would come eventually.
He knows that she can't get into the spirit world. He's been visiting, and there's been no detection of Korra or Rava in the spirit world since he hurt her.
Wait, you've been going to the spirit world from here? He's all like, yeah, it's the spirit world. I don't need to, like, have freedom to go to the spirit world. It's pretty wild. That's your problem. You don't understand all the spiritual energy all throughout Republic City. Let me explain it to you as I rush you and try to scare the shit out of you. My name is Zaheer.
I really do not like Zaheer. This is a rough scene for me. I know that he's like one of the favorite antagonists of many people. I really cannot stand him.
Well, let's talk about why. Because he has no fucking real plan. The reason is because he's an anarchist. It's just like, hey, just overthrow everything and just fuck it. Like, just let it burn. But the best order is disorder. And it's like, okay, yeah, but we see that, like, actually, Korra's response to that is actually really powerful, which she, you know, she's like, calls him out on his shit. Like, yo, you started this shit and left me to clean up a mess that has left, like, a worse dictator than what we had with the Earth Queen.
Mm-hmm. He basically just created more human suffering with his ridiculous ideals.
Yeah.
Sorry, he just gets me tight. So he tells Korra that... She says that she thinks the poison is the reason that she can't get in. Basically, that he injured her and she's really struggling. And he says that blaming him is a crutch. That her issue is that she believes her power to have limits. He believes her power to be limitless. Korra tells him...
Yeah, and he makes a good point. He says, anybody else, that poison should have killed you. The fact that you're even here talking to me lets me know that your power doesn't have limits, because there's no way you should be having this conversation with me. You should be dead.
Mm-hmm. So because of his role in creating Kuvira, he agrees to help Korra, that they should be allies in this. And he says he can accompany her into the spirit world. Korra reluctantly agrees. She doesn't trust him, but she's feeling like she's basically out of options. And so she begins to meditate with him. As she's meditating, exactly what happened to her in the spirit wilds happens again. She starts to see the battle between them. And Zaheer tells her, let it play out. Mm. Let it play out. You're okay. We know how this ends. Just let it play out. As she does that, she's able to break into the spirit world. And he doesn't stay there. He doesn't linger with her. He gets her in. And then he basically leaves her there. Essentially, she connects with Rava as soon as she is in the spirit world. Rava makes herself known, tells Korra she was always here. She wasn't able to speak to her. And Rava is able to lead Korra to where the airbenders and the tourists are being held. Rava tells Korra that if she can connect to all the spiritual energy in the spirit world, she can bend them out. And she's able to do this. When she does this, Janora and the others are able to leave the pods in the spirit wilds right away. As Korra leaves Zaheer's prison, she tells Mako that although she'll never forget what happened between her and Zaheer, she can learn to accept it. And basically says that she feels better. She thinks that accepting it is going to be able to help her recover fully. In Republic City, Opal begins to prepare to leave on her secret mission with Lin to save her family. And Bolin shows up and pleads for forgiveness once again, telling her that he loves her and he really wants to make this right. Opal tells him that if he wants to win her back, there is one thing that he can do, which is join her secret mission to rescue her family.
What? To Operation Bayfong. Let's go with the flying boar. Let's go. All right. I love it. I love any episode that has some of this connotation of this family in it. The episode begins with Bolin, Lin, and Opal arriving outside of Zhao Fu. Kavera tore down all the domes in the city, and even I don't understand why she did that, because ultimately those domes were protection, but maybe she has a plan. We'll find out in a little bit. Maybe that's what she used all that dome metal for. They hear a voice telling them that the prisoners have been moved, and turned around to see it's none other than Grandma Toph Beifong. Oh yeah, she's here, who Opal greets warmly and is just happy to see her grandmother. Like, it's really awesome to see that. Like, she says, oh, I haven't seen you since you were small. Oh man. And it's a little bit chillier with Lin. Hello, Chief. How are you, Chief?
How's it going? It's downright frigid with Lin.
Yeah, it's rough. It's rough, and we'll see more of that to come. Bolin loses his stuff. He is literally starstruck, like any of his fans that have seen a Nut Tuck film. Okay, like he can't control himself. He loves Toph. She's his hero, Toph is says that she's been keeping an eye on Zhao Fu from the swamp, and when she arrived, she learned that the prisoners were moved to a re-education camp. Bolin knows where the camp is, and he better had, because, man, let me tell you, Opal was like, where would that be? Like, she was not happy that he had any knowledge of this, but she used it. Meanwhile, Raiko has assembled Varric, Asami, Wu, Korra, and Mako in his office, and Varric tells him that they have developed a flying mecha tank. Raiko demands that they use spirit vine energy and weapons, and both Varric and Korra tell him, no, it's too dangerous, and they refuse to do it. And finally, Varric has a conscience. He's like, I'm not going to develop this weapon. He's kept to stuck to his, pardon the pun, guns on this one. And Korra explains why this is an issue. Korra comes up with a plan to ask the spirits to help defend the city. Wu suggests evacuating the city, which is his first good idea as a leader.
Ever. That's it, period. He's never had a good idea before. Everybody's full stunned. Stop. Everyone's stunned. They're like, oh, wow, okay, that's helpful for once.
Yeah, and then he takes it all away and says that he was just doing it to impress Korra because he wants to try to get his date. Good Lord. But I do like it. I do like it. I do love his move. In the Earth Kingdom, Junior, Julie, and the crew run a demonstration of the weapon in advance to show it to Kavera. But the weapon almost explodes, and Batar Jr. finds a broken part and demands that they take apart the machine and rebuild it by the next day. Kavera's starting to be a little bit skeptical about what's going on as well, right? So Lin, Bolin, Toph, and Opal sneak into the factory and see the weapon. So Toph senses that there's a cavern protected by a lot of mecha tanks. Just then, Kavera arrives to check on the project. She's starting to feel like something's going on. When Julie tells Kavera that she's doing everything to perfect the machine, Toph notes that Julie is lying, to which Bolin is pretty hyped about. Because he thought Julie was like a traitor, you know? They sneak away. And Opal suggests that they should take out Kavera while they're there. But Toph says, I came here to get my family. I didn't come here to get into your war. I don't care about the Kavera, and I don't care about Republic City. And she just basically toughs out on him. I came here for one purpose and one purpose only.
Can we just also note that Opal is all in for revenge? I don't know how I feel about this.
Yo, Opal's hot right now. Opal's
one of those people that every time you talk to them, they have like a particular issue that they have to discuss. And her issue is taking out Kavira.
That's
people
it.
Are like, good morning, Opal. We need to take out Kavira.
You mean like he's seen the Night King? He's looking to his eyes? Like, is that what you're talking about? One issue candidates out here? Like, let's take out Kavira. Oh, well, you know, we're going for breakfast and food. Let's take out Camaro.
basically. This is,
oh, man.
I kind of like it because it shows her devotion to her family. But on the other end, I'm like, can you make an argument that actually compels other people?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So Bolin comes up with a plan to wait until after the guards and the factory workers will be demonstrating the weapon, because there'll be less people, you know, guarding or in the factory, because they'll all be out on the weapon test. So they say that's a good idea, so they're going to wait. That night at camp, Lin and Toph have it out. Toph can sense when it's bullshit. We know what's going on, and Lin has got some issues. So Lin is upset that she never got to know who her dad was. Toph is very dismissive of Lin's feelings. And, you know, she like kind of says, she, you know, Bolin even asks, like, okay, who was her dad? And she dismisses and comes up with a name that we've never heard before. I did some research. I can't find anything about this guy.
Yeah. It seemed like Lin was especially hurt because Toph responded so quickly to Bolin's request, and she never wanted to talk about it with Lin, who had asked many times before for more information about her father. This is really heartbreaking. Their whole relationship really upsets me.
Yeah, it's really tough. It's really tough. And she tells her, like, you know, she says, I'm done with you after this. And Toph feels sad, but then says, if that's what you want, then okay. But then it's rough, man.
Toph is her own worst enemy. She really struggles to change in any way. She can see that she's causing harm here, and she's upset about it, but she still can't. It's not in her capacity to just say, all right, well, let's talk this out.
Super stubborn, yeah, for sure. So in the morning, the weapon is revealed. For the demonstration, they will blow up an empty town a few miles away. Meanwhile, Toph, Lin, and Bolin sneak into the cavern. Lin lets each member of the Beifong family out of the suspected prison and tosses them across a cavern where Bolin catches them.
Are we going to talk about Batard Sr. here?
I mean, we see where Junior gets it from. A little bit soft. A little bit soft. It's crazy. I don't know what's going on. What do you think?
Listen, I would also be afraid to be flung across an open cavern to a teenage boy. Or I guess Bolin is probably like in his 20s now. But like, across, all the way across. I get it. I understand why he was scared, but they don't have time for this
at all.
They just don't have time. Like, they don't have time for him to be scared, because while he's doing this, the guards have been alerted. They know that they're in there, so they gotta move.
But they weren't alerted until he started screaming. Like, when they threw him, like, they were fine. It was like crazy. Anyway, they would have got out of there. It's wild. And they do escape. They all get out, and as the test begins, they find another problem with the weapon, and it doesn't go through. This time, Kavera is pretty clear and suspects Julie immediately. When found out, Julie tells Kavera, you're a monster, and she has no regrets.
Julie is a G.
Oh,
she
so good.
She's like, and? Yeah. I was never working for you to begin with. Like, I love it. Julie is an underappreciated character.
I 100% agree. Yeah, she was so smart to figure out that this would have been the best way to stay close to what was happening, to dismantle it while still saving, you know, those guys, you know, Varric and Bolin. So it was really dope. So now that Kavera knows that she's not with her, Julie is to be tied up in the town where they will fire the weapon. Golly, what a monster. She's right.
Yeah, she's just going to execute her. This is in front of everybody.
Yeah.
Unhinged. Kavera is unhinged.
Yeah, and so when they reunite with Opal, she tells them about Julie, and Bolin says that he has to save her. Lin, Sue, Wing, and Wei go to help Opal and leave Lin and Batar and Huan. Batard Jr. starts the demonstration and sees that Opal's in the town. He wants to stop the test, but it's too late. However, the missile misses. The whole ray, the spirit ray, it misses them. And Lin, Su, Wing, and Wei fight with Kavera and her men. They're eventually cornered by the mecha tanks and Kavera's soldiers. But the greatest earthbender of all time, and don't you dunderheads forget it, okay? Shows up, Toph Beifong, and comes to their rescue. The whole ground shakes, the tanks fall over, Kavera falls over, and she leaves her with some bars. You give metal benders a bad name. I created this shit. You're from the original. I'm the originator. You're terrible. And they leave on Juicy's back. Juicy's got a runny nose, so but he don't mind. He don't mind.
Always. Can we get Juicy an antihistamine? Like, what's going on here?
Something's going on.
Yeah, he needs some medication or something.
I'm a little tight that, like the top was like, I thought Appa was stinky. Couldn't you have chosen a different bison? And she's like, you don't get to choose your bison. The bison chooses you. Or I would have given, trust me, I would have given him back a couple of times. It's not right. But then she's doing this while she's hugging him. Mixed messages. Come on, Opal. After the escape, Lin, Su, and Toph speak, and Toph tells them that she knows she wasn't a great mother. But she ended up with some really great kids somehow. She asked them not to hate her, even if they can't like her. And Lin, rather than be like, no, we don't hate you, Bob, she's like, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then she says, no, she's not going back to Republic City. You know, that's why Katara didn't get involved in the North and South Civil War. Sometimes you just got to leave it to the kids.
No. Weak.
Yeah. We don't accept
it. You know who did get involved?
Zuko.
So yeah. Weak. Weak excuse.
Yeah, weak excuse. Sorry. Try again, show creators. Anyway, Julie tells them that they need to get back right away because she has information that Kavera plans to attack in 2 weeks. Whew. Korra enters the spirit world through meditation and asks for the spirit's assistance. But the spirits tell her something that I think is pretty profound. They say, you are trying to do the same thing that Kavera is doing. We as spirits don't get involved in human wars.
Yeah, I don't blame them. I really don't blame them.
No, I thought it was good, which is why I kind of landed where I landed about where like the Fire Lord kind of came out, because I just kind of feel like it was a very Iroh-ish kind of thing, and she obviously has some affinity for Iroh because she named her son Iroh, and it kind of felt like connected to like Iroh's connection to the spirit world, and that's why I kind of like her decision. But I also just like that the spirits are staying very neutral. They're like, we're not doing this. They're harvesting spirit vines. You're trying to get spirits to fight on your behalf. This is like exactly what we don't want to be involved in.
Yeah, and they have no reason to trust humans. Anytime humans use the spirit world, they use it for the wrong reason. So they have really no trust between humans, even the Avatar. I mean, spirits have said over and over again that just because you're the bridge doesn't mean that we trust you, because you usually align with the humans.
100%. So what do you got to talk about with the White Lotus?
So this week, acceptance was very big in, you know, multiple episodes. Like, the theme of acceptance was heavy at play. Korra's been through a lot at this point, and she spent months traveling the world looking for answers. She trained with Toph in the swamp. She reconnected to herself and her loved ones, and she removed the remaining poison from her body. And yet, none of these things have managed to fully heal her. During her recovery from her trauma, the path forward is not always one back to your former self. Sometimes you can't go back to your former self. Mm-hmm. The Korra that we know in book 4 can never be the same Korra that she was at the beginning of the story. All of our experiences shape us into who we are. But Cora is so focused on returning to normal, getting back to her former self, that she hasn't been able to accept what happened to her. In order to regain some of her strength and focus, she has to accept what happened. Lynn also had to grow into accepting her past. She's been carrying around this resentment for her mother for so long that it's basically part of Lynn's identity. In the end, Lynn has to decide to love her mother for who she is and accept that she can't change their past relationship. Acceptance doesn't mean liking, choosing, or supporting what has happened. It means acknowledging that you cannot change it and deciding how to proceed in the moment. For Cora, acceptance meant that she could acknowledge that she's not all powerful, but still believe that she has some power. Mm. For Lynn, acceptance is knowing that she can't change Toph, but deciding to forge forward and have a relationship and love her anyway. Both Cora and Lynn became more open and able to move forward because they accepted the circumstances and are no longer allowing those circumstances to hold them back.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I really love that. I really love that. And it is really much a big part of these episodes. And on that note, we wish you all a wonderful week and wish you health and happiness. And whatever you're journeying through that you find acceptance for and find it on the other side of it and move forward, you know, like so and heal from it. Full healing, whatever it is. I got a lot out of these episodes, honestly, and a lot out of this whole series. It's been really cool. I watched them. It's really great. So.
Well, we'll see you next time. Thanks,
yes,
everyone.
Yes, indeed. Here we go. One more left. Unbelievable. Only one more episode where we will, close out the series. Amazing. What a run.
I know.
See you next week.
Bye, everyone.